Author Fatima Gilliam is a lawyer, consultant, WAMC panelist, and founder of the Azara Group, where she works on issues of leadership, equity, and organizational culture. Her new book, Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You, tackles the everyday assumptions, comments, and behaviors that often shape cross-racial interactions in America. Drawing from personal experience and professional insight, Gilliam explores everything from microaggressions and white privilege to the hidden social codes that can quietly damage relationships and workplaces. Rather than focusing only on theory, the book offers practical guidance for readers hoping to better understand race, challenge misconceptions, and engage more honestly across differences. Again, the name of the book is Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You, and it's a pleasure to welcome Fatima Gilliam to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to talk about my book.
Very nice to have you. So let's talk about what the impetus was. What brought you to want to write this?
My family has lived in the United States for nearly 400 years. So we have a very interesting and, you know, complicated relationship with the United States. I mean, we've been here for a long time and fought in every American war going back to the American Revolution. And professionally, you know, I started my career as a lawyer, you know, worked on Wall Street as a corporate attorney for a number of years. I also worked at Citigroup overseeing their diversity recruiting for the U.S. businesses. And in my consulting practice that I have now at the Azara Group, I give advice to people and organizations. And I've advised people, I've watched a whole bunch of mistakes take place over the years. And one day I was watching the news and it was a story of a Karen going viral for calling the police for no reason on a Black person. And as I watched that story, I started to think about the mistakes I've seen over time, the rinse and repeat blunders, the advice I've given to clients or seen people, you know, take or not take over time, and just rinse and repeat mistakes. And I also thought about the things that white people say around me when they don't realize I'm Black because I'm very light-skinned. And in watching the news story, I had this sort of aha moment, and I thought, oh, white people need a manual. And so I wrote the book because I had the idea for it and wanting to give people advice, since I'm already in the advice game, and very different from a lot of books that already exist about race, because they'll talk about systems and structures or history and how racism manifests in society. And maybe someone will talk about it from the perspective of their personal journey and how that could inform the reader. But then, like, what do people do after that, right? They need some solid advice, some do's and don'ts, some guardrails on how to not do terrible things unintentionally and hopefully definitely not intentionally. So that's a long answer to say that. That's why I wrote the book.
The subtitle is What Your Black Friends Won't Tell You. Why won't they tell us this?
Because white people are too fragile. I mean, that's just a reality. You know, like, even people who think that they are the most evolved, woke, liberal, whatever it is, and they may have a bunch of Black friends, but or even maybe married to somebody who's Black, or have somebody in their family, or may have a Black child. And that doesn't mean that that person is going to be totally honest with them, because either the white person is not going to receive the information well, they may get defensive, or they just are tired of the emotional labor that goes into explaining things over and over again. So a lot of people just skip it. But I wanted to rip the Band-Aid off and tell people what, you know, what harms they're causing, what we may be thinking when they engage in certain behaviors. And then they know, and then they can't say nobody I never told them. What they choose to do with that information is up to them, but they can't say they weren't told.
So there's many things that you address in the book, but one is white privilege. How do you define that, and how do you define that for white people who may not realize there is a privilege?
You know, I think a lot of people like to engage in exceptionalism. You know, it's one of the things that I try to drive in my book. Like, people tend to think that that racism is something that takes place over there, right? It's down south right now where they're trying to resurrect Jim Crow 2.0 with voter suppression and gerrymandering, right? They think that it's the person who walks into the supermarket in Buffalo and shoots everybody up. They think it's the person who's got the swastika and the Confederate flag and that are burning crosses, and they think it's like the tiki torch people. But they're not thinking about it in terms of the choices and actions that they engage in on a daily basis that uphold the status quo privileged power structure that enables them to get a leg up, that enables them to engage in, opportunity hoarding and having an endless advantage that is just available to them because they are white.
When you say opportunity hoarding, even if you want to avoid that, how do you avoid that?
I think people need to be mindful of how many of the things that they have, by choice or not by choice, has enabled them to go to college, own property, get access to jobs, generate wealth in a way that is not available to people of color. One of the terms that I invent in my book, I call it, is a term called white welfare. And I say that it is the ultimate entitlement program for white people. It's built on things like indigenous genocide, the enslavement of Black people, the Homestead Act, tax codes, the GI Bill, a whole bunch of things that have created this society where there is exceptionally divergent outcomes with wealth and opportunity. And so, to your question, like, what should somebody do when they're privileged or when they don't recognize their privilege? If they don't recognize it, like, look at some facts, open your eyes, and see what's happening. You could just see what is happening in this country right now. And if you don't want to see it, then you're comfortable not seeing it. But if you do see it, then I think it behooves people to do something about it.
You mentioned white welfare, and you read about this in the book. It's one of the race rules. Acknowledge all white people benefit from privilege and white welfare. So, as a follow-up to my last question, how do those two differ of privilege and white welfare?
I think they're intertwined, right? Because the privilege that you get enables you to expand, build on, and continue to benefit from white welfare. And white welfare, therefore, enables you to remain privileged. So they're interconnected. They're building on each other. They're feeding off of each other. The question is, what are people going to actively do to break the chain so that they're not getting this unfair, uncompetitive advantage out of the sheer fact that they're white? Now, I also know there are going to be plenty of people who listen and say, well, I haven't had an easy life. My family was poor. We came here with like $5 in our pocket. We, scratched and survived to create a life for ourselves. And to people whose minds go there, I say a couple of things. First, if you immigrated here and then built a life for yourself, then you follow the yellow brick road of opportunity. That yellow brick road was built by Black slaves. It was built by Native Americans having their land taken. It was built by the Chinese that helped build the railroads. It was built by a whole bunch of other people. And so folks need to recognize that they didn't just come here and, have some sort of reboot. They built on the sacrifices that people made, not by choice, for them to have that opportunity. Now, for the person who's like, I grew up really poor, racism and me talking about privilege doesn't mean that white people don't face adversity, doesn't mean that they don't face difficult times. But that's about class. That's not about race, right? What I'm talking about is that the outcomes that you have in life, the circumstances that you're in, are directly linked because of race, right? Like, somebody might be poor, but they're not poor because they're white, right? They're poor because maybe they're not educated. They're poor because maybe they've been generation after generation poor, but it is not because they are a white person.
Fatima Gilliam is the author of the book Race Rules: What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. You mentioned the fragility early on, and you talk in the preface of the book about the role of brutal honesty. Why do you think, I mean, you mentioned the fragility, but why is there a need to be brutally honest, and how do we do that in a constructive way?
Well, I mean, to that I say, like, where has diplomacy gotten us? Right? Like, we have been exceptionally diplomatic for centuries, tiptoeing around on eggshells around the fragility and feelings of white people, that they're going to become uncomfortable, that they're going to have to face some truths that they have no desire to face. And as a result of it, then there's so much time, effort, and energy that is wasted, frankly, tiptoeing around those feelings. And then where is the evolution in that? Where does the person really learn from that? How does society evolve from that? And if the diplomacy worked, then we wouldn't have the current, like, racist white supremacist Supreme Court that we currently have, that just blew up the Voting Rights Act, that somehow is trying to make the South rise again and resurrect the lost cause. We wouldn't have these people that want to continue to cosplay that they're Confederates and talk about their family lineage when it's like, okay, well, your lineage is genocide and slavery. We wouldn't have people continuing to try to combat diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, at every turn. So I think at some point, somebody needs to be honest. Most people don't have that kind of courage and gumption like I do. So I'm happy, more than happy, to be the person that does it. I will do it unapologetically.
What does it mean for you to be a racism disruptor? What does that look like?
It means that you don't just recognize and see that something is, you know, terrible that's taking place, that's discriminatory or racist, but it means that you have to pair that with action. Right? There are a whole bunch of voyeurs in society. They're watching something terrible happen. They're sitting in a meeting and they see somebody, like, you know, discount the contributions of the Black person in the room, the person who gets, you know, passed over for a promotion, the person whose work product is stolen. And then they see it, they know what's going on, and then what they choose to do is absolutely nothing. Or they go up to the person afterwards and say, you know, I just think that what Bob said to you in that meeting was just so terrible. Okay, well, keep your comments to yourself, right? What does that signal? That means, like, in the meeting, the person didn't say anything. They didn't act up. I mean, they didn't speak up. Instead, they wanted to virtue signal as a sidebar after the fact to feel good themselves that they're somehow ideologically aligned, but they're not aligned in terms of disrupting anything, do anything. So my point is that people have to take action. There are studies done where a whole bunch of people, you know, say that, you know, they observe, they recognize that there is prejudice taking place, and they themselves see themselves as allies. But then when the study follows up and asks them, did you take action? Did you do anything about it? Overwhelmingly, the study showed that they didn't do a damn thing. So to me, how is that person any different from the full-blown racist? They're not. They're not. Because ideology can be helpful to a point, but it's not actually going to change anything. It's not going to improve anything unless the person takes action. And we can unpack that right now, if you want, Joe, by talking about what is happening with the Voting Rights Act.
Yes. Give me an example.
A lot of people recognize that what the Supreme Court did in effectively eliminating the Voting Rights Act, right? This quintessential landmark legislation, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, that goes hand in hand with the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that is when you can say democracy really started to function in America, because everything before that was like the patina of a democracy, because people didn't have full citizenship rights. They couldn't really vote. But that legislation made it so that people could vote. Tried to get rid of the nefarious things that take place predominantly in the South to limit the ability to have Black elected representatives and people able to vote. So you have a whole bunch of people right now that are like, oh, this is so terrible. I can't believe this is happening. We're reverting to some Jim Crow 2.0. This is utterly racist. Okay, I do not disagree. But then my question is, what are you going to do about it? Because to me, the ultimate test in this moment in time is what are white people going to do about it? These terrible things that are taking place right now, are they going to continue to sit back comfortably and just be like, ooh, I'm watching the horror show? Or are they going to step up and protect these rights? Are the people dressing up like frogs to go to the Indivisible No Kings protest? Are they going to go to the protest to support voting rights? Because there always tends to be like this fissure, this break when it comes to things that are more clearly black. But the reality is, so many of the rights that people have in this country right now flow directly from the benefits and the rights that come to black people, right? It used to be that women couldn't vote. Uneducated white men couldn't vote. White men that didn't own land couldn't vote, right? And these things change, and a lot of it comes from civil rights, pushing for rights for blacks, pushing for rights for indigenous people, and that is how their rights flow. So my point is everyone going to be a voyeur? Is everyone going to be a spectator in the horror show of the resurgence of overt white supremacy? Or are they going to protect the rights? Because if they do absolutely nothing, they are just like the Klansmen.
Let's look at Memphis, Memphis, Tennessee. And this is a city that is obviously going to be greatly influenced by and greatly impacted by the decision. And already this area is being split up, and we're seeing those areas be diluted. So how much of that is the responsibility? So I understand what you're saying. I'm just trying to say, I'm trying to figure out who takes the first step, because you are looking at something within, in that city, for example, who makes the first move and what do they do?
I think some of the things that people can do are, I mean, it's going to be difficult because they've already made their vote, right? Like the legislature already
Right.
voted. So to me, then the response to that is on the one hand, there needs to be a very aggressive get out the vote effort, a very aggressive voter registration effort, an aggressive effort to make sure that they're not purging legitimate voters off of the voter rolls, to make sure that th that is not happening in tandem with excessive voter suppression, right? I think those are some of the things that people can do. I think people can also look to see what's happening in their own community, what sort of voter suppression is happening in their own community that they should then pressure in their state. If they're not in Tennessee, if they're not in Alabama or Louisiana, they can say, like here in New York, why don't we have a Voting Rights Act? What is Chuck Schumer doing? What is Kirsten Gillibrand doing? They sound pretty silent. They're typically silent. What is your member of Congress doing to make sure that people have the right to vote here, right? To make sure that we're going to have an election that means that there is unfettered access to the polls for, 18-year-old American citizens. Those are some of the things that people can do in their own community and to make a stink about it. In the company where they work, why aren't they issuing a statement in support of Voting Rights Act? These are things that people can do. And they can also just go to Google and come up with a list themselves of things that they could be doing.
What do you think companies and corporations should be doing in this, the role of corporate America in highlighting these injustices?
I like to say that we're living through the era of profiles and no courage. There's an extreme shortage of courageous leadership. And what companies could be doing are making statements about it, adding pressure. In 2005, I think it was, when the Voting Rights Act was up for reauthorization, because it had to be like reauthorized, every so often. And the business, what is it, the BLC? I think it's the Business Leadership Council down in DC of like major corporations, Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies. Companies, surprisingly, like Disney and Walmart, were at the forefront of encouraging then President George Bush to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, right? There's a role that companies can play. Sometimes we like to think that there's this significant division between corporations and the government. But that line is totally blurred, right? There's a lot of power on both sides. And Wall Street does a lot of driving what's happening down in DC, and they should be using their power. The problem is a lot of these CEOs, they're either getting on planes with Donald Trump to go to China and bend the knee, or showing up at the inauguration, giving $1 million for this and that, basically showing that they're not just complicit, but they're collaborators and co-conspirators. So with companies, there's a challenge right now, but that means that the people that work in those places, that are employees in those places, need to be applying pressure. I will say on another level, I think we need to boycott the SEC that was at the Southeastern Conference. Like, we should not be going to their Peach Bowl, their football games. We should not send our children to those schools. We should not be boosters at those institutions. If people cannot vote in the South, then we have to find strategies to financially cripple the South so that they change behavior. Because asking people nicely is not going to change behavior, but hitting people in the pocket will.
Let me end with this question. I'm interested in your level, if any, of optimism. Are you optimistic?
If I didn't have any optimism, I wouldn't have written the book. I think that is the reality. If I didn't have optimism, I wouldn't be, working on things that I think and hope will improve things in American society. Black Americans somehow, in many ways, are some of the most patriotic people that you'll encounter because they haven't given up on the place. We have every reason to just flip the country, the bird. And I don't mean leave here, but I mean just like check out and not participate, because it's not like this is an inviting and welcoming place,
Right.
right? So the fact that somebody like me would even take the time to write a book for a population, many of whom are a lost cause, but there are plenty of them who are not, right? To me, that is a sign of optimism. The other thing that I'll say is, my book Race Rules, I also see it as a negotiations book as well, right? Because if somebody's going to go to a place like Japan, they don't think about the fact that before they go to Japan, they may need to understand something about the culture. They may need to understand something about the history of the people, how to not engage in behaviors that might be like completely taboo, that might destroy a relationship, whether that's for a business deal, whether that's for a personal relationship. But they never think about it within the context of their own country. They don't think about how they need to have some cultural intelligence and some cultural fluency, competency skills to navigate living and working in the United States, whether that be because they're negotiating a deal or they're negotiating a relationship that could be as simple as a friendship or it could be a colleague. So, I wrote the book so that people can connect better across differences. The challenge is that the book is coming out now when there's this dumpster fire taking place in American history. So the question, as I say before, is what are people going to do about it? Because if they decide to do absolutely nothing, then their silence is the speaking language that they've chosen to engage in. And that speaks volumes. And I say that because I know that there are plenty of people that listen to your station that are white liberals, that are Democrats, that think they're allies. But that is why they need to be proactive disruptors. Otherwise, what they're doing is they're just transferring intergenerationally racism and its ongoing legacy. And I'll just say this one final thing. I had a really interesting encounter this past weekend when I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I was talking to this woman because there are a lot of lines because the fashion exhibit opened. So there are a lot of people there. And so I started talking to this woman in the line who was from Mississippi and talking about life down there. And I was like, oh, it's interesting times down there that you have taking place in Mississippi, and started to talk about what's happening with the Voting Rights Act and the resurgence of racism. And then these three other women who were not a part of our conversation but were further south chose to interject themselves in this discussion and started defending the South, talking about how that racism doesn't exist in the country and the South is not racist. And I'm bringing this up because a lot of people think that we're in a post-racial world. A lot of people think, again, the racism that's on the planet is just not daily in their lives, right? They don't see it that's present. And so this is the question that I'll pose to your listeners. When they encounter somebody who is telling them that something is racist, instead of having a defensive response, a knee-jerk reaction where they reject it, maybe what they should do is ask themselves what in their own personal experience makes them the expert on the topic. And given that they're probably not going to be the expert because they're not the person of color in the conversation, then they should ask themselves, why would somebody like me draw that conclusion? And then they should go educate themselves to understand why I would draw that conclusion. Why do I think the South is racist? Why do I think the country is racist? Why do I think everyone is holding racism inside of themselves and needs to do something to sort of change it? So those are some questions that I want to pose in this very critical time in American history. You know, we are at an inflection point. We are either going to hold on to democracy and civil rights, or we're going to let it go. And letting it go, we're going to return to an apartheid state. And then people have to say, what did I do in that moment in history when they look back? And it's the same question that is posed of the people that let Nazism come to the rise, that just let the people goose step and march down the street and then watched in horror and then decades later engaged in revisionist history to say that they weren't a part of it or whatever. If you're not doing something about it, you're a part of it. And so that's what I want people to think about. And they should look at a book like Race Rules, because while I give people advice on things like color blindness, voting rights, taking a knee, how to apologize, how to define racism, color blindness, all of these things, right? Where it's sort of like a real-time, choose your own race knowledge adventure. It also includes advice. It includes some history. It includes some reflective questions that people should be asking themselves. And maybe what they could also do in this time is they could form a book club with their friends and their family and go through some of the questions. Because if we're going to get past this moment in time, it's going to be by that self-analysis that people need to go through in this moment and not looking around and saying it's somewhere else. No, it is in your house, it's on your television, it's sitting in the bed right next to you. And until we unpack that, we're just going to get more of the same. So that was a long answer for you, Joe, but I really want, I say all of that. If I had no hope, I wouldn't even be talking to you right now. If I had given up, I wouldn't even have shared that advice in this moment. And so I think people should say, if not now, then when? If not me, then who? Those are the questions.
The name of the book is Race Rules: What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. Fatima Gilliam is the author. Fatima, thank you very much for being with us this morning. I appreciate it, and we look forward to hearing you soon on the panel.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Be well. Again, the name of the book is Race Rules: What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.